Next case on our calendar is 97-1670 Mildred Williams versus ITT Financial Services. Mr. Vanderline.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case presents three significant issues which we believe merits this court's attention. First is dealing with what the Court of Appeals did in establishing a new unprecedented standard of underlying liability in the state of Ohio, by which the Court of Appeals acknowledged it was supplanting existing Ohio law. The second issue deals with the whole question of punitive damages post BMW versus Gore, which this court has not, to this point, addressed. Finally, it presents a very significant issue that has been pending for some time in this state. Indeed, this case once before attempted to bring the issue before the court, and that is the question of contractual arbitration rights that a party has, where a contract provision provides specifically for arbitration of a commercial dispute. The first issue I would like to address is the Court of Appeals standard of lender liability, whereby the court eschewing what has been heretofore extant Ohio law in the whole issue of fiduciary relationship, where this court, as recently as 1996, an opinion authored by Justice Douglas, reaffirmed the standing notion that when a debtor-creditor duty is established, that goes back to the Umbaugh Pohl versus Scott case of 1979, where that particular point was first enunciated.
The Court of Appeals here seemed to say that the ITT was active in the failure, the misrepresentation, or the not the, really misrepresentation, but the sort of the scam that was going on here. Can you comment on that?
Yes, I think it's notable that if one reads the Court of Appeals analysis of the case based upon the facts presented in the court below and trial, that ITT would have been should have been awarded a directed verdict on all the issues. The question here is that, according to the Court of Appeals, because certain people at ITT at least have some information to the effect that Mr. Blair at Homestead Construction was having some financial difficulty, that, as a consequence, that should have been disclosed to the borrower, in this case, Mrs. Williams.
Well, was it financial difficulty, or was it the fact that the builder here, to take the facts to the best of their argument, that the builder here was not intending to repair homes of these low-income persons, that they sort of preyed on, the argument is they preyed on.
I don't believe that's what the Court of Appeals determined. Indeed, I think they found just the contrary. I would direct the Court's attention to basically the pages 4 and 5 of that appellate opinion, where they acknowledged that Mr. Blair, pursuant to his own rebuttal testimony, intended to complete this contract in question. Indeed, he had started it, and it had several weeks of performance under the particular contract. I think the analysis gets flouted when one listens or takes into consideration the argument that's been made in briefs by opposing counsel, but what the Court of Appeals found doesn't support that, and nor does the evidence of that.
Counsel, you ultimately seek us to reverse it and reinstate the arbitration, is that correct?
I believe that is probably the correct result, yes.
And if we do that, if we don't accept the Court of Appeals analysis of the right hand day in court, we're going to forget about arbitration, just sort of what people say. If we reverse and reinstate arbitration, do we need to reach any of the other issues in the future?
I think it's essential and very helpful, at least to think of throughout the state, that the court does. And particularly, I would say, on the lender liability issue, so that there is no mistake about what the correct standards are for lender liability here in Ohio.
But the reverse of reinstating arbitration, doesn't that make the rest of the opinion moot and no value to the position it's currently got in?
It could render such law dicta, but I think dicta at this point is better than leaving the substantive part of the Court of Appeals opinion intact. That's why this presents a very difficult case procedurally and substantively because of just the point which Your Honor raises.
Would you speak to the issue of why we should go back to arbitration now that we have a full trial on all of that?
If meaning is to be given to the notion of contractually based arbitration, we cannot countenance, I don't believe, as a matter of law, a blatant disregard of such contractual rights. The arbitration provision in this contract is not only a procedural device, it is a substantive contractual provision. So if one is to say, we understand that the contract exists, then that contract should be enforced with respect to all of its provisions. If we say the contract doesn't exist, that's a different issue. But that's not what we have in this case.
So the only appeal rights under the contract provision would be formal statutory appeal rights for fraud or misbehavior on the part of the arbitrators. It's not an appeal that just we don't like the decision.
Correct. But I think, and frankly, if this court is going to accept the notion that, well, you have a real thing because you have a trial, again, that's not the law. And I think we pointed out instances, including instances here in Ohio, where this very problem has arisen, where one party articulated a contractual basis for it, the court refused to enforce, but nevertheless, the case came up and had to be reversed and remanded to arbitration. This, by the way, is a very issue which Justice Wright pointed out as a possibility back when we were here the first time attempting to enforce the arbitration provision, and the court dismissed the appeals improperly granted. We were left with the law of the case then, which I believe very clearly required an evidentiary hearing on the existence of the contract, which the trial judge below refused over and over again. And then refused to accept the notion that there was any more than accept the arbitration at the time of the trial.
Counsel, the arbitration being the other approach, I suppose, procedurally to this case is that if your client were to prevail on the matter that you argue on in the substance, that because agency, that a case was tried on agency theory and not on the theory of a civil conspiracy, and in as much as the Court of Appeals could be affirmed on its view of that your client was entitled to a directed verdict on the agency issue, then the arbitration matter is mooted somewhat. You agree?
I believe it's mooted somewhat. I believe
you'd still like the court to speak to that, I suppose.
Yeah, I believe the court, if the case would go back, remanded for arbitration, then we'd at least have the correct guidance of the court about what the substantive law is applicable in this particular case. I believe if the court does not address the substantive issues, that it leaves a dilemma for the arbitrator ultimately, and in view of the existing limited liability notion was voiced by the Court of Appeals, which was not what was presented in court at trial.
Why would it be remanded for arbitration in the event that it already had a trial? Why would it be necessary that it be remanded then if the court were to reverse on the and find that a directed verdict was in order in the trial? You would want it remanded and have another arbitration?
If that were the court's finding, that it was a directed verdict on all bases, should have been awarded,
okay.
I would not want it remanded for arbitration.
All right, I figured that. What about you make the argument that the plaintiff did not try the case on the theory that the Court of Appeals relied upon in its judgment. Yet the plaintiff did plead. I mean, it seems undisputed that the plaintiff did plead a civil conspiracy.
don't play the civil conspiracy, but again, one has to look at the object of what the conspiracy was. The object is to make a consumer loan that is secured by their home mortgage. That's not an illegal act. The problem is what was presented, what was pleaded and presented was based upon a theory that Christopher Blair, Homestead Construction, were the agents of ITT, and as a consequence, those acts by Chris Blair and his...
In failing to complete the job, you know, you have to understand, we have to sort of sort this out. What was his fraudulent act was failing to complete the job or seeking a contract when he didn't have the means to, you know, we have to really get to that too, don't we?
The best gloss one could put, I believe, on what Chris Blair did wrong was that possibly at the time that he commenced the work and received the funds, he knew he did not have enough to complete the job. If that were the case, that would be kind of...
Yet he testified that he expected to complete the job.
His testimony was clearly that he believed that he could finish the job. Indeed, he paid a subcontractor, I think it was related to him, and he thought the job had been completed. It wasn't until he learned after the misdemeanor's claim that it had not been. At that point, he did not have additional funds to go ahead and complete. But he said it was always his intention to complete.
What about the evidence the jury heard that your client knew that these kind of occurrences were happening because it had happened with other people, they'd had complaints, even the two specific men involved knew about it? Isn't that something we should look at, or just the jury did?
I would say, no, it's not relevant, but if the court is going to look at it, there is no other circumstance similar to this one. In the testimony that was brought into the court of other customers, you had one instance where the construction was completed and the people were not satisfied. Another one where the construction was not completed, the person wasn't satisfied. There was another instance where apparently it didn't even start. But it was a variety of different issues. I think, as we pointed out, this is not information that the particular loan officer at the branch where this loan was made had, was even privy to at the time the loan was made. And I think if one looks at the precedent that the Court of Appeals latched onto to try to create a new standard and go to Minnesota even, I would recommend the Puerto Rico Bubble case, which is one that they rely on heavily. That was one where the court did not impose a special relationship on...
But didn't the jury also hear testimony that IT&T knew that Blair was making payments on other customers' loans?
There was some information of that, yes. That he could not complete a couple of contracts, and therefore he paid his way out. That doesn't constitute fraud. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, if I could. I know I'm saying a couple minutes left. But I don't believe that, again, if one wants to accept an expanded notion of responsibility on the part of lenders and go to the Minnesota cases, they are not going to support the notion here, which the Court of Appeals has latched on to. As they say, they like the reasoning of Judge Garvin in the dissent, but that's not the law of Minnesota, nor I submit the law of any other state in the Union. The other point I would like to make, this relates to punitive damages, it relates to the whole nature of the affirmance, frankly, of the damages awarded here. It's very clear, looking at the Court of Appeals' opinion, that it is imposing upon this case a theory that was not presented below. Indeed, if one accepted the theories presented below, as the Court of Appeals noted, we would have been entitled to a directed verdict. Yet, nevertheless, imposing an entirely new theory 7 years after the fact of this particular loan transaction, the Court of Appeals nevertheless then says the punitive damages which were awarded by the jury, $1.5 million on basically a $15,000 transaction, was appropriate. I submit, Your Honor, that whether BMW versus Gore even exists, that that's a violation of due process. That is imposing damages, punitive damages, to a significant degree based upon theories that were not presented. That can't stand.
Well, your point, I think your point is, I think, in the briefs, is that the Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's law on the agency issue, and that's what was argued to the jury, that was the basis for the punitive damage. So you should have a chance to, I guess, go back to the jury, if that's one remedy, is to go back to the jury and argue on whatever the law is.
Thank you, Mr. Blessing. Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the Court, I'm Bill Blessing, and I stand before the Court today representing Mildred Williams of Lincoln Heights, Ohio. I'd like to address, first of all, this issue that something was decided on appeal that was not presented to the jury or before the trial court. The plaintiffs alleged and argued, and the jury was instructed on a conspiracy or concerted action theory. The plaintiffs also alleged agency. Now we get into a semantic problem here to a certain degree, because in the law of conspiracy, the parties, as a matter of law, becomes agents of each other. We do not contend, and never contended, that Chris Blair was an employee of ITT.
But in either theory, I'm the general theory counsel, isn't it necessary that you have some fraudulent conduct?
Absolutely.
That is to be the underlying unlawful act.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Unlawful conduct, fraudulent conduct. And here's the fraudulent conduct here. Chris Blair knew when he did the transaction he would not use the proceeds of Williams loans to do her job. And he knew that for other jobs.
Now, does that in itself, I don't know, maybe that does. I don't know whether that, the fact that somebody is behind on their finances, which a lot of, you know, small business people can get that way, and using, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul, all in the hopes of eventually catching up, is that enough?
This is the classic Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
Working, trying to pay the last guy on the next project you're doing, working all.
Well, that's not a Ponzi scheme, but whatever. You think that's the unlawful act?
That's the problem. Mm-hmm. Knowing when he contacted Mr. Williams that he was not going to use the proceeds of what he got out of her loan to do the job.
And there's testimony that who testified that he knew that?
Chris Blair testified himself.
That he knew, because I thought counsel just said he said that he intended to be able to do it. He did know he was going to pay some other job off, I guess, but.
Quote from the record, he knew that he did not intend to use the proceeds of that loan to
right.
do the job. Record, the supplement. Page 55, transcript, page 386. He knew he was going to use the proceeds of that loan to pay previous obligations. Record, transcript 372-73, and our destination for record 46-47.
Okay.
Chris Blair admitted that he was not going to do that, and he knew it. And this had been a pattern from him, a pattern over the years that had generated complaints to ITT. Their employees knew about their own, the Blair loan situation has become common parlance at ITT. Complaints come in.
I guess the problem gets to be, at what point do we hold a bank and the individual, you know, we all know there's loan officers sitting in branch banks and they're doing this kind of thing with various customers, contractors. When are they, when do they feel confident in telling a third party that the fellow with whom you're doing business is a bad guy without the fear of being later held responsible by that customer for offering that sort of information?
I don't think that it is radical at all to suggest that a bank loan officer who knows the proceeds of Mildred Williams' loan are not going to be used to do the work that she's placing a multi-percentage mortgage on our home to do. I don't think it's risky at all filming with Williams the truth in that situation. The truth that was known. Now, the bank had sought out...
And they need a duty to do this, don't they? Because
correct.
Under the law, we say it might be a great thing, but you say there has to be a duty to speak.
You right? say ITT comes into it because they have an obligation and not to loan people money that Blair brought into them?
No, that's not the situation.
Tell me how ITT gets responsible for Blair's activity.
ITT is responsible as a conspirator because it assisted and participated and reached an agreement with Blair to perpetrate this scheme. It assisted not merely by making loans. In fact, the evidence shows here that ITT itself acted before Mildred Williams was even had her door knocked on by Blair. ITT had selected the house, had run an appraisal on it to make sure that it didn't have a first mortgage on it. And the appraisal had been run, it had been selected before Blair went with his modus operandi to knock on the door and solicit her.
Did they select Blair to send him over to the house?
They knew. The evidence is that they knew Blair was going because they wouldn't have known that Mildred Williams existed except through Blair. And the dates, and it's page 231 of our supplement, shows the dates. There were dates that they selected the deed for the house, did the appraisal, before Mildred Williams was even contacted. The dates that it was the 20th, 23rd of November. She wasn't contacted until the last day of November, first day of
November. So you're making the lending institution responsible for the shoddy work of a workman?
No.
Because he has shown in the past that he is not reliable and does not finish his work.
Making the lending institution responsible when it knows that Blair is perpetrating fraud on the customer, that he will not use the proceeds to do the work, and that he hasn't done so in the past. That is a scheme. And they participated in that scheme by acting in concert with Blair. What were those acts? Those acts were, one, targeting the home beforehand, not disclosing what he knew to Mrs. Williams.
And how did that...
Let me back up. Targeting the home beforehand.
Yeah, how did they do
it? Out how that
worked. Okay, here's the way
how do you
Blair know what you're on the home? What you're on the home? I don't know. He do that by performing after deeds were pulled and a determination was made as to whether or not they leaned this principle.
And who was engaging in that?
ITT, the documents show, and I'm referring to the record 231, before Mrs. Williams' phone was even selected. We have no testimony on that. We know that, well, the fact of that is they didn't select that phone, they didn't run an appraisal.
Why would they do that? I would say that they have somebody out cruising the streets to see homes that were more repaired.
Money to me on the house.
Blair indicated that he was the only one, that he was the one who selected Mrs. Williams' home.
This is to pre-qualify for her for a loan, so he could go to her and say, you can get a loan? Is that the real reason?
He did not testify to that. He testified that he told her, and Mrs. Williams testified, that he told her that he could get the money for her. It could be that the term is not used.
What law says that Blair, that it's a fraud for Blair not to take the proceeds from the loan that her corporation contract with the client, he gets the proceeds, why can't he use it to pay off his overhead and use other money to have some other deals to actually hire people? What law says he has to use this money on her deal only?
Your Honor, I believe it's general common law fraud law.
Did he attack
Hiram's contractor? No, Your Honor, he did not. He had some people working with him.
Did he pay anybody?
He was unclear about that.
Did somebody in the record testify that he paid someone to work on the property, whether it was Shoddy or not?
Some work was done, but he paid for it. I do not think the record reflects it.
What's the interest of ITT in doing this? How did ITT benefit by making a loan to a person who couldn't, you argue, couldn't pay it back by working with somebody like Mr. Blair? How does ITT come out of this with anything ahead? Where they got a house that can't be, they've given money to a person who apparently takes it and doesn't spend it on what it's supposed to be spent on, so they're stuck with a bad loan, I guess, or could be.
For the loan officer, the positive thing is you've got a secured loan. That's as good as gold. We have a house here with a value of around $31,000. They had a mortgage on it for around $12,000. There's plenty of room there for all the attendant expenses and foreclosure. And for the loan officer, it is...
They did not foreclose on her house, though.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. And didn't foreclose on any of these houses. Is that right in the record or not?
Your Honor, they did foreclose. I believe they took... I think the record before the court is that they brought common police court actions or municipal court actions on 41 of these actions.
Municipal court actions? What? Not a foreclosure.
It's one of the two, common police or municipal. I don't know, but they brought suit on 41 of them in that kind of situation. But the...
Were these Blair cases? 41 Blair cases or just 41 bad loans?
The record is not clear about that. We know that numerous of them were Blair cases.
Yeah, what was the record?
That record, Your Honor, was generated out of a total of municipal court proceedings, and it was presented to this court when it came on the court in 1991 or 92. And that was on the evidence of the unconscionability and bringing this case within our arbitration of savings clause.
That wasn't part of the underlying trial in this case?
That was not part of the underlying trial.
That's not in the record. Then why is the record
not in the case? Well, Your Honor, it is with the common police court record that is before the court. But this is the same case that was presented earlier.
Counsel,
yeah.
Going back to, I guess it seems to me fundamental to a connection here, the jury heard this business that you're alleging before Mrs. Blair came to the bank, before Mrs. Worthington came to the bank, and before Blair visited her, the bank already had started a file on the property.
That's the dates on the records and so indicate, Your Honor. Yes. The jury heard that.
Now, was part of this whole, what I could call it, is it a conspiracy theory? What was your theory that you were presenting to the jury?
Conspiracy, concerted action.
All right. Was part of it the first loan, because I'm having trouble understanding why ITT made that first loan to her. I mean,
I argued, Your Honor, that the only reason that the two loans were made is that you could double up on closing costs. Now, Blair made some comment that the first loan was made in order to get him started on the work until a mortgage could be done later. But the fact is, he didn't start on the work, didn't do anything until after the second loan was closed. It was done within just a few days of each other. There's no rational business reason for the two-step loan process other than to extract double closing costs and related expenses.
Well, the first one had, I see here, an interest rate of 27.4%.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What's the loan chart and criminal usury statute?
I think the usury statute, Your Honor, and at that time, I'm thinking 28%. It did not exceed. We never brought a point that it exceeded the usury
statute. In any event, if this money were used and the job had been completed in accordance with the arrangement, the two loans made, the interest rate on the first one was 27%, I think on the second one 17%.
That's right.
Was there any way Ms. Williams' income, which as I recall was something like $500 from Social Security or SSI or something. Is there any way that would have supported this loan?
No, Your Honor. There's no way she could have made payments on this loan. She had previously had a credit card bill that her son had been responsible for and was paid part of it. Now, those credit card bills were paid off as part of the transaction here, and we agreed throughout the process that that amount should be credited to ITT. That's $3,300 in change. But there's no way with that kind of income, less than $400 a month net.
What did ITT say when you questioned them about that subject?
ITT said that they did not address that issue.
They did not address the issue?
As to whether she could pay or not.
Did they say that whether or not the party can repay the loan is not important to them?
The question was given to Blair. Blair said he wasn't concerned with it. He left it to ITT, and that ITT wasn't concerned with it either. The question, I believe, was not answered when pressed on the person who made the loan, which is Tom Schultz.
Well, did you show that this was a pattern of ITT, that they made loans to people in such an amount that they knew before the loan was made that this person could not repay it?
Your Honor, we presented evidence from a number of people who were involved in the Blair scheme. They're all of them elderly, all African American, all in lower income areas. And I cannot sit and tell you today whether we went through the financial circumstances of each one, but I believe evidence was presented to the jury that showed that this was a pattern that took place. People couldn't pay off the loan.
But you didn't press ITT on that subject?
Oh, yes, Your Honor, trial.
Why did they say they made the loan, or did they consider the loan at all, repayment, in giving it?
They merely said they thought it was a good loan, and they didn't offer an explanation. Certainly the jury didn't hear an explanation and satisfaction.
Did you show them by figures going through each loan that it's on plain view for anyone who would look at them that based upon the income of the parties that it would be impossible for them to repay these loans?
Primarily, with Milton Williams, Your Honor, we took them through dollar and cent on everything.
And what did they say to that?
They couldn't get a response.
You've used your time, Mr. Blessing.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Vanderlyn, you've used your time. Just use your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
I believe the record does not support most of what you just heard in terms of what was presented at trial. No one was pressed. The only person...
Is ITT concerned with the repayment of their loan by the parties?
Absolutely. That's what the testimony was.
What do they do if they see a situation that the counsel has told us existed in this case where the two loans, it is impossible for her to repay it?
Well, the two loans, the first loan was rolled into the second. The first loan was then reduced to a 17% loan. She at that time was already paying $190 a month on her credit card charges. Those were discharged. In addition, she was getting proceeds in order to have her house improved.
Well, then he's wrong then that the evidence shows that she was unable to repay this loan?
That's absolutely correct, because the testimony of ITT was that she did meet their loan criteria, and that came from Mr. Stires.
What was it?
Roughly $500 a month at that time with no mortgage free and clear. So this would be basically...
That's gross.
The only debt she had apart from...
I thought she had fixed expenses of about $190.
She did.
$430 a month.
Well, the $190 were these expenses. That's what this monthly payment was.
No, I thought that was before this expense.
Yes, it was. And that was the expense of the credit card debt she had, which got rolled into this. So before the dust settled, she had a $190 a month payment to make with respect to her credit card bills first. After it was done, she had $190 a month to pay for her credit card expenses plus the money to have her house fixed up. The check that ITT wrote out, by the way, did not go to Chris Blair. It went to Mildred Williams. She had the ability to use that money as she so chose.
Thank you, Mr. Vanderlyn. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.